spot on that pleated dress, always staying up late to do her homework and prepare for the future. Odessa was the naughty one, the sassy one, the one who didn't stay at home but sat at a bar with a cigarette in one hand and the thin neck of a bottle of Coors in the other, humming the tune of some country and western song about why it was silly to worry about tomorrow when you might get flattened by a pickup today. The one who dressed like an unmade bed and could care less about it. The one who liked nothing better than to drag her sanctimonious sister through the mud in a little game of football and then kick her teeth in for good measure. In 1983, when the editors of Forbes compiled their annual list of America's 400 richest individuals, they had discovered that six people, each worth $200 million or more, according to their calculations, lived in Midland. As for plain old millionaires, which in a town like that had become as notable as people saying they were going to church on Sunday or planned to vote Republican. In 1976, Midland County became the first county in Texas where more Republicans voted in a primary than Democrats. Various estimates pegged the number at 2,000 or so during the height of the boom. If the number was accurate, one out of every 45 people in the town in the late 70s had reached millionaire status. Forbes published a glowing 9-page article about Midland. Despite its eye-popping wealth, the article said Midland had still retained all the quaint virtues of a small town. There are no chained storefronts, traffic jams, or pedestrians wandering around wearing Walkman headsets. The Texas League baseball park still has billboards on the outfield fence. There were a few blemishes, according to the magazine, but they came from Odessa. "Why, I can pick out Odessa guys on sight," said a high school student. "The guys are big, muscular, wear gaudy jewelry and belt buckles big enough to eat their lunch off of." At virtually the same time, Odessa found its way into the national press as well. For Murder Capital, USA. It isn't much, just a depressed oil town in an arid stretch of West Texas, wrote Newsweek. But last week, little Odessa, with 29.8 homicides per 100,000 residents, gunned its way past Miami to take dubious honors as the most perilous city in the nation this year. It was easy to see why the two towns hated each other. When oil started booming in the late 40s, the availability of office space had made Midland a corporate center. As the grunts of the oil business flocked to Odessa to work and service the fields, the majors and the colonels and generals came to Midland to control those grunts who worked the fields. They were a different breed, with eastern roots that often included 4 years at St. Paul's, or Choate, or Lawrenceville, or Andover, followed by 4 years at Yale, or Harvard, or Princeton, or MIT. They were men with the hearts of pioneers and teeth sharpened to razor points by years spent dutifully at the knee of their good daddy capitalists back east. Although he turned out to be the most famous among them, George Bush was just one among friends. In 1951, shortly after Bush had moved to Midland, the New York Times described it as a modern city whose 23,000 inhabitants could raise $200 million in capital with little effort. As the years passed, the place became ever more exclusive. Residents named streets Harvard and Princeton. They played at the Polo Club, which had been started by a graduate of St. Paul's and Princeton, whose father had been an executive at U.S. Steel. They sang high praises of a black waiter named Max because of his flawless performance at formal dinner parties at their homes. They clearly saw their town as the one exception in an area of the country once described as having enough ignorance to support not simply a 4-year university, but an 8-year one. People in Odessa, watching what was going on over in Midland, could only shake their heads amid the smoke in the bar and wonder why God, of the millions of damn places in the world he could have put them next to, had chosen one as strange as Midland. The Ivy League didn't cut much muster in Odessa, unless Yaley meant the same thing as Okie, and Odessans didn't seem bothered one bit by the oft-repeated slogan that people went to Midland to raise a family and to Odessa to raise hell. There was no dispute that Odessa had its share of one-word bars and prostitutes, and sometimes the only way to win an argument was to shoot the guy. But it was free and fun-loving, and a man was measured by who he was, not by how well he concealed the size of his income. Beyond oil, the two towns had nothing in common. Not in outlook, not in the style of the clothes they wore. Odessans dressed free and casual, whereas it could be presumed that Midlanders wore polo shop pajamas to bed. Not even in the quality of excess that marked these towns during 9 very remarkable years, from 1973 through 1981. Part 2. There were some nice stories about the boom that came out of Odessa. There was the one about Jerry Thorpe, pastor of the Temple Baptist Church, going with a parishioner down to Vegas by private jet to watch the Holmes-Cooney fight, and being given a $10,000 watch by him as a token of appreciation for all those inspiring sermons. There were several wonderful stories about the legendary Ron Wells, who, according to his banker, had started his oil field supply business with about $10,000 and suddenly found himself with monthly cash flows into the hundreds of thousands. There was the one about how he invited his banker out to the warehouse under the guise of discussing business, and they sat around drinking champagne instead, and then hopped over to the airport to pick up the Learjet that Ron had just given himself for his 30th birthday. And since it was kind of stupid to let the plane just sit there, and the day was pretty much shot anyway, they flew to Vegas and gambled all night. There was another one about the huge party Ron threw for his customers out at the warehouse, where huge cattle tanks were iced high with beer, and how he got up toward the end to thank everyone for coming, and then mentioned something about his Air Force, and how his two planes, by that time he had a 16-seater Gulfstream 1 prop, as well as the Lear, flew low overhead with the symmetry of the Blue Angels, and how some of those in attendance were pretty impressed by the sheer balls of it all, and how one guy immediately whispered to his partner that from now on he wanted old Ronnie to pay for his supplies in cash, so they wouldn't get stuck with a huge unpaid bill down the road when the upkeep of the Air Force and all the other toys got too expensive. There were stories of welders who had trouble getting through the alphabet without taking a break, making between $80,000 and $90,000 a year, and were so flushed with money that when the State Highway Patrol picked them up for drunken driving in West Odessa, they often had $8,000 or $9,000 in cash on them. There were stories of them marching into Gibson's, the big discount chain that eventually went belly up like everything else, and plunking down $2,000 or $3,000 to redecorate their mobile homes from head to toe. There were stories of big, burly men coming into town in Rolls Royces to sell as many Rolex watches as they could dish out. There were stories of competition in the oil patch turning into a mafia turf war. Companies arranged kickbacks for buying certain products, and a black market in stolen equipment thrived. There were stories of men who suddenly realized that they were born to be oil operators, not the doctors and lawyers and shoe salesmen they had been before their conversion. Men who, as independent oilman Ken Hankins put it, wouldn't know a drilling rig if they walked up on one. There were the usual hair-raising statistics, how over a 10-year period through 1979, total construction in Odessa rose 520%, and population 31%, and bank deposits 294%, and retail sales 276%, and divorces 28%. They were all nice stories until you compared them to what was going on in Midland. Then they seemed like the kind of stories passed around an Amish quilt circle. Greed, delusional visions of grandeur, the mercenary mercilessness that made every relationship expendable. Midland perfected all these, long before they became the standard of the 80s around the rest of the country. Part 3. Of all the deals that Aaron Giebel had made from his base of operations in Midland during the boom, the hardest part, by his own account, was figuring out which one was the worst. Had the 5 planes and the 3 full-time pilots to fly them really been necessary? Should he have bought the Brangus Bull for $1 million? Should he have paid cash for the 1,000 head of hybrid cattle? Did he think it through as carefully as he should have when he took a multi-million dollar position on a method of breeding super cattle by hormone injection and embryonic implant? Had it been reason enough to pay $17.5 million for the 7,000-acre ranch in El Indio with the palm trees that had been flown in, and the private runway, and the breathtaking view of Mexico when he used it largely for entertaining and hunting? Should he have planted the 28,000 pecan trees when the only thing he knew about pecans was that they're all named after Indians? Had it been such a wise thing to go into the home construction business with his former son-in-law and end up with a loss of $1.2 million? Had he really needed the trucking business that cost him $4 million to move drilling rigs in and out of the oil field? Had he been slightly impulsive when he decided to open 5 additional offices in San Antonio, Oklahoma City, Denver, Calgary, and Lafayette, Louisiana? Had the revolving $24 million line of credit over at the First National Bank of Midland truly been a good thing after all? Was it possible to have built a new house that wasn't 13,000 square feet? It was all so hard to know. By the time you added it up, Aaron Giebel's losses from boom to bust totaled somewhere around $55 million. He had filed for bankruptcy, and by 1988 he was back on his feet again in the oil business, although on a far reduced basis. He still had his wife, and he had his health, which was more than he could say for a lot of his friends, who lost both when the absence of money for impulse trips to Paris suddenly made them seem a lot less attractive. He was the first to admit there was no justification for what he had done, except that he had gone literally mad in Midland. But he spoke about it with candor, as if he saw a danger in what had happened that needed to be exposed, materialism and a desire for money and wheeling and dealing that became as impossible to resist as any addiction. "There was a euphoria around here that was almost like an opiate," said Giebel. "It was an opiate. And I succumbed to it, and I don't know a guy who didn't. You just get caught up. You get caught up in the euphoria like you're sitting down at a gambling table." For a period of time, Giebel had actually resisted it. By nature, he was a careful man. He had a round, soft face with eyes that seemed incapable of anger, and there wasn't anything remotely swaggering about him. He spoke softly, without the twang, that in some seemed to reverberate from one end of the state to the other. Born in Fort Worth, he had moved to Midland after college and ultimately became the chairman and chief executive officer of the MGF Oil Corporation. The company grew enormously during the boom, and when Giebel resigned in 1979, he did so with millions of dollars worth of stock. He had resolved not to build another oil company, but he did. A.F. Giebel Petroleum Consultants. With the price of oil skyrocketing, Giebel found himself worth $100 million. He still restrained himself from other investments. But as he saw friends everywhere expanding, he wondered if he was not crazy to do the same. "I felt that I was behind the progress curve. I was demeaned by my peers. Giebel, you rich dog, what are you going to do, eat it?" They got to him. In Texas, no man was more of a coward than the one who was chicken shit with his money. So he had jumped, thoroughly convinced that all the odds were in his favor. And how could he lose? Not when the price kept going up and up. not when just about every banking and investment institution in the country said oil was going to go to $65 a barrel, not when Gebo Petroleum had drilled 195 wells with a fantastic 55% success ratio. He had the Midas touch. The moment was suddenly at hand, not only to make ungodly sums of money, but to build an empire, a lasting monument. I made fast decisions. I just got to wheeling and dealing. I'll have a dozen of these and a half dozen of these. I got in on so many deals. It changed me, because I was one heck of a businessman, said Gebel. I became a fast-moving promoter type. And so it went, from oil exploration, which he knew a great deal about, to loyally following the creed of Texas entrepreneurship during the boom. The less a man knew about something, the more money he was obligated to sink into it. In 1981, with oil hovering around $40 a barrel, any idiot could have made money from it. But hitting big off something you didn't know the first thing about had special meaning. Brangus bulls, pecan trees, trucking, home construction, they all became shiny new toys in Aaron Giebel's ever-widening collection. Just hearing him talk about the technique to breed super cattle was enough to make the hairs on the back of the neck stand up and wonder how this man, with dual degrees in geology and petroleum engineering from Texas A&M, could have spent vast sums on a scheme that sounded as if it had been borrowed from one of those comic books about the possibilities of life in the 21st century. Gebel wondered that himself. He had gotten into it through a veterinarian friend. The way it worked was that he bought super cows that cost $17,000 apiece. These super cows were injected with hormones to increase ovulation drastically and cause the production of multiple embryos. The embryos were removed and placed in common cows who would then produce super calves. Every time his veterinarian friend came back and said he needed just a little more money before these Frankensteins dominated the cattle world, Gebel dutifully anteed up. He lost $7 million on the deal. We're talking failure to the square root, was the way he bluntly described it. Gebel had also got caught in the classic Texas trap of who could be the most flamboyant and outrageous. Flipping a coin once with a fellow oil man to see who would get the drilling rights to a tract near San Antonio. Gebel won. Frankly, it was hard to see how this method of investment differed from how he approached all the other ones he was making. If anything, it may have been a little less impulsive. If Gebel had been the only person acting out of character in the quest for crazy quilt expansion, it would have been more difficult to excuse or explain his actions. But he wasn't. From 1973 through 1981, when the price of oil went up more than 800%, he and thousands of others made the fatal error of forgetting that every ounce of their success was due to the geopolitics of the Arab oil embargo and the Carter energy policy and the Iranian Revolution. They had actually thought that they themselves had something to do with what was happening and were somehow in control of their own destinies. Over at the country club, or in enormous corner offices with picture windows that seemed to deserve something more than wide-angle views of scrub brush and mesquite, they confused luck with business acumen. Instead of understanding that they were the beneficiaries of history, they began to believe that they were the creators of it. In Odessa, it had been a matter of riding the boom to the hilt and just trying to keep up with it. In Midland, it had been a matter of the town's becoming even more improbably tall than it already was. The Brasilia of the United States, with the linear coldness of Gotham, a town where all human scale was rendered insignificant by the sheer magnificence of achievement. Of all the places that got caught up in the frenzy of the oil boom in those days, Midland may well have been the most incredible. There had been many indications that things were getting out of hand, but the one that confirmed it was the opening of a new business east of the airport. If you had something to sell, odds were you could do it in Midland or Odessa. At the height of the boom, Odessa ranked second in the country in retail spending per capita, and Midland fourth.